the J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Alan Gibson from J-Soccer Magazine joins me to chat about the three Kansai teams in J1, but also some news that broke on Monday morning Japan time regarding Urawa Reds. And later on in the program, Neil Debnam, Kawasaki Frontale Rabbit himself, will return to the pod to discuss the defending champions and how they're getting on through the first five games of the new J1 campaign. A top-of-the-table clash on Saturday at home against Hiroshima did not quite go to plan for Frontale. But firstly, as I mentioned, Alan Gibson is with me. Alan, welcome back to the podcast. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Playing lots of football, watching lots of football. And now let's talk about it.
Terrific stuff. All right. Yes. So I wanted to get you on to discuss the state of the three Kansai clubs in J1. But then just for something new, Urawa go and upstage us all with a big announcement on Monday morning. I guess with them right down the foot of the J1 table, it's not hugely surprising, but a big move after just five games of the season, Alan, to fire manager Takafumi Hori.
Yeah, I think it's probably the right decision. I mean, this man who came in and took them to the AFC ACL Championship has, I don't know, for want of a better word, he seems to have lost the dressing room. I mean, we could look at Gamba, for example, and I'm sure we will later, of course, who are below them. But the difference between looking at a Gamba game and looking at a Reds game and the body language of the players and, you know, that kind of thing, it does seem that the Reds were just dying off, not giving their 100%, and nothing was going right, except Nishikawa, who seemed to be coming in with his saves left, right and centre. But, they've done what was necessary, I suppose, ripped the band-aid off, as they say. The new man is, Tsuyoshi Otsuki. Mm-hmm. And he's in the, director of the club academy and manager of the under-18 side, I think. But already rumours are surfacing of various names. Anybody that's ever managed in the J-League is probably getting a mention already. And the latest I saw just before I came on was Nelsinho.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, yes, been out of work for a little while since leaving Kobe. Obviously a strong pedigree and a J1 winner, of course, in his time with Kashiwa Reysol. I mean, it's only five games, and we often say on the podcast, Alan, you know, it's such a small sample size, we can't overreact to basically what's gone on so far because it's such a long season, etc., etc. Reds have drawn two and lost three of their first five. I mean, obviously that's not fantastic form, but I mean they've scored in every game except one. This latest loss came on Sunday, the only game of the J1 Matchday 5 played on Sunday away at Iwata when they went ahead through Shinzo Kuroki, but then a brace from Kengo Kawamata saw them defeated. But yeah, I don't know. To me, it just smacks of being too early. But as you say, if the front office have gotten word that yes, that Mr. Hori's message isn't getting through as it did last season, then I guess it's the right time to do it. Whenever is the right time? It's really impossible to know, isn't it?
Yeah, you can never really tell. I think a lot of people just, again, I mentioned Gamba again, look at Gamba and say they're even worse off, but they seem to be playing better, and obviously they have a new manager who's completely changed the team around, as opposed to Mr. Hori, who's basically playing with the same players, but it's just, you know, they're not doing the same, they're not giving the same performances as they were, so a completely different thing there, and hopefully we won't wake up tomorrow morning with Olivia Kolpigar from Gamba.
Yeah, well, stranger things have happened, but yes, you wouldn't have thought so, considering the way that Gamba finished last season. But yeah, I mean, we assume that Mr. Otsuki is a temporary appointment, and yes, a big name such as your Nelsinho's will obviously be in the frame for the job, and yes, a permanent appointment I'm sure will come in fairly due course. But for now, yes, Reds have to get back on the horse, and they have a home game coming up this Saturday against the Sendai, which at the start of the season would have looked like a home banker, but it's second visiting second from bottom. Of course, Sendai have surprised us all with their fast start to the season, second in the table, as I've mentioned just there. And, yes, so they'll be sure to take it to Reds, who are obviously rocking at the moment, and that will be one of the more interesting games, I imagine, on the match day six slate. All right, Alan, that's Reds covered for now. You're not anticipating a change in at the top of Gunba Osaka. Let's talk a little bit about them. I promise you, I didn't just want to have you on because Gunba have just got been beaten by FC Tokyo, but that is indeed the case, of course. In the last game before the international break, of course, Gunba came back from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with Kashiwa Reysol. It looked like the script was going to be followed again at Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday before Diego Oliveira had the last word.
Indeed, it's exactly what I wrote on Twitter about half time, I think, where I said, well, Gunba have done 2-0 down just for Huang to score two goals. And he did. but then Diego Oliveira spoiled that one just a few minutes later. But as a man who's watched Urawa a couple of times this season all the way through the games, plus the highlights, and watched Gunba a few times, but not as much as I usually do, actually. And I got a bit of stick on Twitter from various people, but, I mean, the Nagoya game, for example, the Gunba should have won that easily, in my opinion. And then FC Tokyo, Huang had a shot cleared off the line in last time as well, right? Mm. They could have had his hat-trick. So, I mean, from the difference between Urawa, who basically have given up after they've gone behind, and Gunba, who are going behind and then coming back and even right into the 94th minute are still going for it. So, obviously, Kolpe does have the dressing room on his side at the moment. I think the problem is, and is it a problem or is it something that we have to be patient about, is that he's bringing so many kids. And of course, these are not the kids that are the Kakitani, Kagawa, Inui, and all those guys we had at Cerezo. Mm. They are, well, I mean, they might be, who knows, you know, but at the moment they're not. But even going down 2-0 FC Tokyo, the three players that came on, one was a debutant, Mori from the under-23 team had been promoted. One was a 17-year-old forward, and one was, had to say, was 20. It's not like he brought on Kondo or someone to bring in some experience. He just kept throwing on the kids. So I think Gunba fans are going to have to be a little bit patient. There are some very good youngsters in the squad. But the interesting thing is when Kolpe took his press conference before the start of the season, and that question came up. He said, "Are you gonna play all the kids because you're brilliant with kids? Look what happened at Cerezo." And he basically said, "Well, no, I had Kakitani, Kagawa, Inui, Kiyotake, and I was lucky. It's a coincidence." He actually used the word "guzen" in Japanese, I think, mm-hmm. before it was translated. He said it was just a happy coincidence that he had all those kids, and he shouldn't be known for it. And then, of course, he goes and confounds us all by throwing all the kids in anyway.
Right.
So I think Gunba fans have to be patient. I don't think they'll be struggling halfway through the season, that we already halfway at the table, in my opinion.
Well, I don't think I got around to asking you in any sort of detail your thoughts about the appointment of Kolpe when you're on with Sam Robson earlier on in the season, Alan. To me, I mean, it seemed a fairly, well, you know, to put it bluntly, underwhelming and uninspiring decision to appoint him, you know, let alone the fact that he used to manage Cerezo. I mean, he's done and did so twice, of course. I mean, I don't know what you, any sort of vibes you picked up from the Gunba faithful, if they were at least a little bit put out that a former Cerezo coach was gonna take charge, and your thoughts on the appointment. And I mean, yeah, he's obviously bringing through these kids, and you might have expected that that's what he would do, but well, now with five games into the season, I mean, what did you think of the appointment at the time? And I guess ultimately you do think it's going to pay off for Gunba.
Well, I've spoken to some people who think he's a Cerezo secret agent who is here to guarantee that Gunba get relegated.
Right.
But I don't think that's the case. I think it was pretty brave, to be honest. The guy who managed the team over the road, that's like, you know, Spurs bringing in Arsene Wenger, you know, or something like that. It's like,
well, I don't think they would do that, would they? Yeah.
I don't think they would. But I think it was an interesting decision, and I think they're prepared to give him the time to do what he did at Cerezo. Whether he's saying that, you know, I mean, I think it's partly modesty as well, to be honest. I mean, he did help those kids come up from Cerezo. Mm. And, I mean, Nakamura, I mean, yeah, coincidentally, it was against Urares in the Levant Cup, but 17-year-old Nakamura took the ball in his own half, sprinted past two midfielders, then was up against Yuki Abe, a 36-year-old international, a very experienced man, and he just strolled past him and blasted it past Nishikawa, the international goalkeeper. So that sort of summed up Reds and Gamba at the same time, I think. But I think Kolpi was an interesting decision, a brave decision perhaps because of his past, and one that I think will pay dividends in the end, as long as, you know, he's got, I think we need a leader, a centre-back leader at the Gamba. Someone like Miyamoto, who's never the greatest and tallest and strongest football player, but he was a manager on the field. Or Sidi Clay or Yamaguchi or all these, you know, Gamba have always had a decent centre-back holding the team together. And right now, Miura and Fabio are not those guys, even though Miura is the captain. Interestingly, the under-23 team, we rarely give any time to, of course, and perhaps we shouldn't. Yeah. But the Gamba under-23 team, last year they struggled near the bottom and they always literally played under-23. In fact, most of them were under-19s. The average age at one point was like 18 and they never played overage players. And this year, Gamba under-23s have been playing a few of these. The youngsters that are already in the top team, of course, are getting a bit of time in the under-23s as well. But also the two centre-backs, both overage, and Gamba have been winning in the under-23s and J3. Perhaps those two should be getting a chance, Suganuma and Nishino.
Right.
So we'll see. The other interesting point is the centre-back that they let go, Kim Jung-ya, is seemingly ever-present for Vegalta Sendai. And where are they this year?
Indeed. yes, second in the table.
To round it up then, yeah, I think patience is needed and it was a decent decision that will pay off, I think, in the end.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough then. All right, well, before we move on from the Tokyo Gamba game, I better give Keigo Higashi his due. I spend a lot of time bashing him. So he put Tokyo into the lead in just the second minute and Masato Morishige headed in Tokyo's second in just the 12th to give them a 2-0 lead. As we mentioned, Huang Weijo equalised for Gamba, a penalty in the first half, Sobisom, and then his brace completed 13 minutes into the second half, but Diego Oliveira as bullet header from Ryoya Ogawa's cross won it for Tokyo in the 64th minute. And before we leave Gamba, one more dig, Alan, that's 15 now without a win in the league, so a big task ahead of Levir Kurpi, but yes, we'll see how he gets on. Okay, we've mentioned Cerezo a couple of times there. Obviously, with mentioning Mr. Kurpi, you have to mention Cerezo Osaka and his history there. They won on the weekend, on Saturday night, defeating Shonan 2-1 at home. Yang Donghuan made his first league start for Cerezo and scored his first goal for them in the just the 13th minute. Takuya Okamoto equalised just past the half-hour mark. But Kenyu Sugimoto, who Yang started in place of on Saturday night, he settled matters with just 4 minutes left with a fine left-footed finish. So Cerezo plugging along, Alan. Obviously, last season they rose from being promoted from J2 all the way up to third in the table, and they've made a somewhat spotty start, especially in the ACL, but yes, a good win over Shonan on Saturday night.
Well, I don't know, I think a spotty start in the J League as well. If it wasn't for that last week, they'd be a lot lower because this table is so squeezed up right now. The problem is that they've got, I mean, Kiyotake has been out from almost the second game, I think, and possibly for longer and probably miss the World Cup, which is sad. And they've got a forward called Sawakami, Fujimoto, Fukumitsu, Akiyama. You know, these are lesser players, but it's all depth that they're losing. Ricardo was dropped from the players listing because I think he seriously broke a hand. And also then they brought in the new guy, whose name is escaping me from FC Seoul. And Souza has now gone out with a hamstring injury. And Yamamura, who I really like, Yamamura, who can literally start almost anywhere except in goal, or come on, literally he can come on as a centre back or a left winger or a right winger or a forward, he's out as well. So I mean, This is a team that, well, they ended their season on a cup win, and then they were back in probably late January. They were probably back training again because they had to start the ACL.
Yep.
So basically they're a retired team who are losing players left, right and centre. And I don't see them struggling for too long. Hopefully they'll win tomorrow in the ACL to give them a chance to qualify. But perhaps losing in the ACL might be a blessing in disguise. But let's not say that. I'd like all of that four teams to go through. I think the key point might be Sugimoto, who's again, he was injured at the end of last season. And because he was injured, he couldn't play for the last month or so. And because he couldn't play, he didn't move. He didn't move to overseas, which everybody was saying would happen. So I think the fact that he's still here is good for the team. And good for him, to be honest. I think another 6 months or a year would be great for him. Mm. And maybe for Japan, it's the national team as well. So I think they'll be okay. I'll have a few words with him tomorrow. I do like the coach. I think Yuni's a fantastic coach.
Yes, so Cerezo in action on the Tuesday night in the ACL. And yes, Alan, you'll be there at home against the Jeju of South Korea, who currently prop up the Group G table. And a win for Cerezo, very important at obviously in the final home game for them in the group stage, because in the final match day they play away at current group leaders Guangzhou Evergrande. That is on the 17th of April. So yes, a big two games to finish the group stage for Cerezo, but if they win them both, then they'll definitely go through. So that's a definite incentive for them. I have to apologise to the listeners and those who are interested in the ACL. We haven't really paid much attention to it so far since bringing the podcast back. And obviously that'll be something I'll be talking about with Neil later on about Kawasaki. But just briefly, the other two groups that feature the other Japanese clubs in Group E, Kashiwa Reysol, third, they host Gyeongbuk, the current group leaders, on Wednesday before playing Tianjin of China away on the 18th. So a similar situation really for Cerezo. For Reysol, if they win both of their games, they should definitely go through. In Group H, Kashima Antlers are top of the pile on 8 points. They play away at Shanghai Shenhua on Tuesday before hosting Suwon on the 17th. And Antler looking good to go through with just one more win. That would guarantee it. And obviously we'll mention Kawasaki and their struggles in Group F with Neil in just a moment. Okay, the third of the Kansai J1 clubs, Alan, is of course Vissel Kobe. And quite a game at Kashiwa on Friday night, and unfortunately for Vissel, they came out on the wrong end of it. Reysol winning 2-1, but this will be just hugely frustrating for Vissel, especially the way they conceded the first goal after having so many chances themselves.
You're not wrong. It was, I might be sounding like a broken record there, but bang, there, bang, shoot, save, pressure. Ball goes out to the right wing, Reysol's right wing. And I think it was Esaka who just sort of hooked it anywhere, but I mean, looked like anywhere, right? Straight into the path of Junior Ito, who just did the rest, you know? That's the kind of goal that kills the game or for one team, or brings up another team right back into it. I've probably knocked Vissel quite a lot on, in the early days. But I've seen signs of Mr. Panofsky in particular, of course, because he's obviously going to be a key player, has sort of broken out of his little funk, and obviously he's scored two goals in a Levan Cup game. Mm. And he's bringing players in. Some of his touches are quite incredible, compared to our normal J League players, he sees things that other players don't. He's obviously a good player. He just needs to apply himself a little bit more to the game and not to various promotions that he's got going on the website or Twitter or his little shops in Germany or Turkey or whatever he's got going.
Right.
And in fact, we've had a few words, Mr. Plosky and myself. I wonder if you'll listen to the podcast. I will actually tell him to listen to the podcast, because we know Mr. Bothroyd listens perhaps, and who knows what other players do, but
yep.
I said a few things on Twitter that about what I've just basically said, that you should concentrate on this and do that and give more back to the fans like everyone else at the club. And he had to go at me for that. He actually saw it. And we didn't speak for a couple of weeks. Then I just, literally, and he actually, he told me to leave his presence at one point, which was amusing. And I did, you know, I understand what you're saying. But I went back to him and I said, look, it's a free press. You can say what I like. But I'm sorry if you took it the wrong way. And he was like, no, no problem. And we had a great chat for about 10 minutes about all sorts of stuff. So I'm okay with Podolski now personally. And as I said, on the field too, he's seeming to be, to be creating things now. If he can stay fit, I think that, he will help Vissel Kobe to rise up the table a little bit. Mm-hmm. Against Cerezo, I mean, he and the whole team had a wonderful game in the 2-0 win against Cerezo before the break. But they've got Gamba this weekend, so haven't they, if I remember
that's
correctly.
That's right, yeah.
So, there's a little segue. I'm not sure about that, you know. I mean, I reckon that Vissel Kobe are sort of waking up now, but Gamba will raise their game. Oh, that's going to be a tough one for me and all the fans, but certainly for me who follows both teams so closely. I think they'll improve as well. I think, basically, I'm just saying all three Kansai teams are gonna wake up and move up the table, aren't they? Which is totally home bias, but I think it's true.
Alright, well, yeah, just to wrap up the game on Friday night, Junya Ito scored the opener for Reysol. Stunning solo effort, and Junya Tanaka against his old club equalised for Vissel in the 74th minute, but Ito, 4 minutes from time, volleyed home a rebound to win it for the host. So, yeah, I wonder, Alan, with Kobe, obviously Tanaka joining a fairly formidable, at least on paper, strike force of, you know, your Havanars, your Wellingtons, of course, Podolski, Kazuma Watanabe, and I'm sure I've forgotten one or two. Omori's still there, isn't he?
Omori's at FC Tokyo, mate.
Ogawa, I'm thinking of, sorry.
Ogawa. Yes, Ogawa and Otsuki. Otsuki's been playing a few games recently, so they have a pretty amazing strike force if they can all, you know, pull them together. And usually there's four of them on the field. It's quite, they're playing a 4-2-4 in theory, although it's sort of a 4-2-3-1. Tanaka has sort of pulled himself into favour. Otsuki has had a few chances, so Havana started a few games, but now he's on the bench. Wellington, he's only started one game, and he's on the bench. He's pretty strong. And then Watanabe, who was top scorer and top assister last year, is also on the bench. So, I mean, there's Ogawa. They played him at right back at one game, but he didn't work out so well. So they've got so much attacking options to play with. But the key point, I think, is the central midfield, and they've got, they're playing Mita from Vegalta Sendai and Fujita, who came in 2 years ago from Segantosu, more often than not. And those two are very good because Woo-young, the Korean international, who returned from after a couple of years in China, he's basically the key midfield player, in my opinion, but because they've had a little defensive problems, they've been playing at centre-back.
Right.
And he's done very well, especially against Cerezo. So he's throwing players around everywhere. So Yoshida knows the players well. I mean, he's only, 42, 43, 44, whatever he is. Maybe he's even younger. I shouldn't insult him. But the players know him very well, and he didn't go for some big name at the end of last season, or even for the start of this season. And I'm quite happy for that because I think he's developed a decent team. He's just got to pick his best 11 now and try and give them a few games.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was kind of getting to a question. I mean, do you see this just all clicking one day? I mean, this project that, you know, Mr. Mikitani has obviously, you know, spending loads of money on Podolski. I mean, they have accumulated quite a lot of you know, impressive talent, not only up front, as you say, Mita and Fujita are a good J1 central midfielders. Is there going to be just a light bulb moment for Kobe when everything, you know, happens for them? Because they seem to have been, you know, building up to a big push up the table for, you know, 3 years now, and it just hasn't come yet. And I'm just wondering if it ever will. I mean, There obviously are instances in recent J1 history of teams that can make a leap, and I'm wondering if it will ever happen for Kobe. Because I mean, with this array of talent, surely it's got to. If it gels, it could be spectacular.
It could, and that's the key. I think I can't see Podolski being dropped, and I know that earlier in the season he was either of rubbing players at the wrong way, rubbing me at the wrong way, rubbing a lot of people at the wrong way. And he seems to have focused himself a little bit more on the team. He's, for want of a better word, Mr. Mkhitaryan's pet. I wonder if he ever did get dropped or suggested that he get dropped, that if there's a bit of pressure from above saying, nope, you can't drop him. And if that's the case, that would screw the team up even more, I think. But as I said, at the moment, against Cerezo, he was brilliant. He was world class. You know, at times he was just playing with the ball and he was directing traffic all over the field. Reysol, I must admit, I was watching it on an iPhone and I wasn't sure what happened, but you know, he wasn't playing badly. And perhaps Vistel were unlucky not to build on that, but so I hate to say that one player can be the key, but if Podolski produces the goods, he will bring the team up around him. If he doesn't, the team will suffer badly. And that's not really an answer to you, is it? Because the light bulb thing could happen, and I think it all depends on Podolski.
Yeah, well, you almost equalised, of course, on Friday night with a bicycle kick in the 92nd minute. That would have been something. It would have definitely made headlines back in Germany and probably throughout Europe as well, I would imagine. But yeah, unfortunately, for Podolski, it didn't quite make perfect connection, and it was a relatively comfortable save for Kosuke Nakamura. But yes, an indication of what Podolski is capable of, and yeah, hopefully for Kobe and indeed the rest of us who are interested in the J League, hopefully he can really start hitting the heights sooner rather than later for Vissel. Let's just round up the rest of the games. And we'll obviously leave the Kawasaki one for part two with Neil Allen. But we've mentioned Sendai, who are second, of course, in the table, the only other team yet to lose apart from Hiroshima. They won 1-0 at home over Nagasaki on Saturday, thanks to Takuma Nishimura's goal in the 31st minute. Yokohama won by the same scoreline away at Shimizu, an early goal from Hugo Vieira won it for F Marinos. And as Sean Galbraith mentioned on the last J1 podcast, F Marinos indeed introduced a new foreigner, Olivier Boumal, from Cameroon, and he made his full debut, came straight into the team and got through an hour at Nihon Daira for F Marinos. Along with Tokyo 3, Gamba 2, the other game for goals on the weekend was Tosu coming from two down at home to beat Nagoya 3-2. Gabriel Xavier's brace fired Grampus into a 2-0 lead. But yes, Tosu fought back from the 74th minute on. Hideto Takahashi got the first one back. Then 3 minutes later, Victor Ibarbo equalised. And in stoppage time, Kyosuke Tagawa won it for Sagan. So bad memories for me, Alan, of I think it was 2 years ago when Tosu did the same thing at home against the FC Tokyo. Well, now Nagoya know what that feels like. Iwata won against Urawa, as we've mentioned. And the last game is Kashima 0, Sapporo 0, Alan. And this will actually lead us on to part two with Neil, because it was another weekend of refereeing controversies in J1. There was a big one at Kashima Soccer Stadium, where Antlers were slightly fortunate, we think, not to concede a penalty against the Consadole.
Indeed. I've mentioned it on Twitter. We've had a look at the videos. I mean, I think basically what people are saying is that the ball did hit the hand of Genchoji, or the arm. I still wasn't convinced. I literally, while we were talking, I would say, but maybe just beforehand, I found another video from Sam, FBAR Soccer Sam, mm-hmm. who showed me a different angle, and it really does look like it does hit his hand. But I watched it over and over again from two different angles, and I thought it hit his chest. I even took a freeze frame and put it on Twitter.
Saw that, yeah.
So you can imagine how the referee feels. You know, it's one of these things where it's just hit or miss. You know, does he bottle it out? Does he give it if he knows it happens, which is probably the best thing, to be honest. But, I, as a referee, I would like to say that it wasn't a handball according to the laws anyway, because the law states that the ball must strike the hand when the hand is deliberately put out to stop the ball. Mm. You know, I mean, but if that was put into practice by referees, then 90% of our free kicks and penalties would not be given. I think I've said it many times before, maybe even on this podcast, and it's time to change the rule, change the law. The letter of the law should be changed to something like, the player gained advantage by the ball touching his arm. you know, then all these penalties would be penalties. But right now, again, Choji didn't put his hand up to stop the ball. He just threw himself in. The ball hit his arm. According to the law, that's not a penalty. I will agree, after watching it over and over again, that, yeah, he touched his hand or his arm. So, you know, we have to I don't know, agree to disagree or whatever. But and I know that around the world, 95% of those are still given as penalties. But they're not handball according to the law. So you're aware of that one, everybody.
Indeed. Well, yes, a controversial decision, most definitely. And yeah, whether the referee got it right or not, apparently he said, I presume, to the Consadole players or to the locker room afterwards, that he apologised for making a mistake, because that's what Jay Mothrew tweeted anyway on Sunday.
And Jay should probably not be doing that, but. And in fact, to be honest, the referee should probably not be doing that either. So the ref might be in hot water, and hopefully Jay isn't, because that was a great podcast by Jay, by the way. I just want to put that one in there for you.
Oh, thank you.
And in fact, if I can digress to, I'd just been speaking to Stan Collymore last week before he went to speak to Jay. Mm-hmm. And what Jay said on the podcast was very similar to what Stan Collymore has put out on his video this week. Where I got about 10 seconds and Jay got about 3 minutes. Damn. But no, Jay said basically, and I'm not sure if he said, he said it to you as well, I believe, but basically they call him Jay-san. If he gets kicked, some players help him up. There's too much respect in the Japanese game. I have to say that I completely agree with, you know, the lack of militia in the Japanese game is killing the national team and a lot of the players' development, because they do treat the opposition with too much respect. And Jay said, to many of these people, it's still a game. That was the key point. He said, it's a game. Mm-hmm. And it's not a game. You know, it's not a game. As Bill Shankly said, it's life and death, you know. Actually, it's more than life and death, he said. But Jay said that it's not a game. It's a living, it's a life, it's a profession, it's something that everybody wants to win, and too many people still treat it like a game. So there you go. I enjoyed that podcast. Just wanted to say that there. So you wanted to say something about controversial stuff? Go ahead.
No. Well, that's all right. Yeah. So, Jay has tweeted that yes, the referee has admitted to making a mistake for not giving a penalty to Consadole. So, I'm not sure in what forum the referee did that, but that appears to have been the case. So, an interesting thing for Jay to reveal, and yeah, whether he should have done so or not, we'll leave that up for debate. Okay, so there is obviously another huge controversy from the weekend that I have to discuss with Neil shortly, Alan. So, I don't really want you to steal his thunder, but that was just astonishing, wasn't it? The way that Kawasaki's equaliser late on was ruled out.
Yep. As you say, we don't want to steal the thunder. Again, as a referee, I want to know what the referee said to his assistant, because whatever they were saying, they still got it wrong. So I'll let you discuss it with the boy, with the rabbit. But, it did seem to be a completely wrong decision for many reasons. I'm sure you'll discuss who touched what and when, so we won't go into that. But, yeah, I agree it was a wrong decision. Oh, but I did notice as I was watching the highlights, and I tweeted again, I think, early this morning, was that the corner that led up to the goal wasn't a corner either, because the ball was headed forward. Patrick was offside, but...
Oh, the goal that Hiroshima scored.
Yeah, they scored from a corner, right? I mean, after a bit of a... So, before that corner, it was actually... Patrick was offside, and in fact, you see some of the Kawasaki frontale players, like, screaming at the referee, saying, he was offside. And he was. So, shouldn't have even been a corner either. So, there's another controversy for you.
All right, well, yes, it's going to be very interesting to see what sort of a mood Neil is in, and I call him up in just a moment. But, for now, Alan, thank you very much again for guesting on this week's episode of the podcast. And what is in the pipeline for J-Soccer Magazine? Which issue are we up to, and then when will that be hitting the streets?
I think we're on issue 27, aren't we?
That sounds right. I didn't want to say that, but I thought that's what we're up to, yeah.
I've been so busy. I haven't considered too much, but there's a lot of interest in the J-League with the Thai players right now. And, of course, I've mentioned them before and told how much I liked Chan Artip last year, and now Tiraton and Tirasin, plus the lesser-known ones, Jacklitz at FC Tokyo and Chowat at CSS Osaka. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that maybe we can have an issue of called JSoccer. We'll call it tsoccer.com. I don't know. That's just coming out of me as I talk to you now. But basically, I thought I'd go for a tie cover even.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, well, Channel Tip's the obvious choice. He's playing every game now, and he's scored two goals, both with his head. Unbelievable.
Yep,
I think he's, what, 158 centimetres tall or something. Tira Sin scored the winner for San Francisco on the opening day, and Tira Ton's played a couple of games for Vissel Kobe and done reasonably well. So I reckon this decision is not made yet, but I think a tie-based issue would be nice.
Fairly topical. All right, we'll look forward to that and more details in the coming weeks. All right, Alan, thanks very much, as I said, and yeah, hope to speak to you again soon.
The pleasure was all yours.
Indeed it was. I'll be back in a moment with Neil Debnam. Next, it's my pleasure to welcome Frontale Rabbit himself, Neil Debnam, back to the podcast. Neil, how are you going?
I wish you'd asked me this question before Saturday's game, but yeah, I'm fine, thanks.
Slightly loaded question there, so I appreciate that. And again, with Alan, I've had him on the podcast after FC Tokyo have just beaten Gunma Osaka, and I'm having you on after Kawasaki have just lost at home to Hiroshima in a top of the table clash. But Neil, can you confirm to the listeners that this is not a setup? And in fact, I did direct message you while the game was still going and while it was still 0-0, so there was every chance still for Frontale to win it.
I believe that's true, but I can't say I saw the message till afterwards, so I don't know how good you are with the old internet trickery. Changed the time so it made it look like that. But yeah, I trust you. I think it was done in good faith.
Fair enough. Well, yes, this is only the second time we've ever spoken, but yes, trust me, you can take my word for it. But yeah, so what an ending to the game, Neil. Obviously, hugely controversial, as we mentioned with Alan at the end of part one. But before we get to what happened in a mad last 5 minutes of action at Todoroki on Saturday afternoon, let's kind of fill the listeners in on what happened in the first 85 minutes, because from what I've read from yourself and other Frontale supporters on Twitter, it wasn't the best of performances, and perhaps Frontale's early season funk isn't the right word, but you've certainly you're struggling to hit the heights of last season.
Yeah, it's that's true, and the first 85 minutes were pretty awful, to be honest. It really didn't look like a top of the table clash. It looked like well, either a relegation scrap or a nothing to play for, end of season, dead rubber. There was nothing good happening in it. And I don't know. I feel like so far this season that's kind of the way we've done things. The results have papered over a few cracks, I think, so far.
Mm.
But it's easy to be ultra critical and, you know, demand, reach for the stars. But it's been pretty disappointing so far this year. But it feels ridiculous to say that when we started the game at the weekend in first place. So it's a funny old game, and it's a funny old season so far. I think a lot of strange results going on.
Absolutely. So an interesting selection decision made by Toru Oniki. He started Yoshito Okubo up front for his first league start of his second stint at the club, and that meant that Yu Kobayashi, on the occasion of him receiving the Footballer of the Year award for 2017, started this game on the bench. Do you imagine that was because he'd just come back from Belgium and Mr. Oniki wanted to play the players who had been training throughout the international break, or just a bit of fatigue maybe for Kobayashi, or any thoughts about why he started on the bench?
Well, it kind of made sense, I think, to start him on the bench because, yeah, the three of our players were away in Belgium for a long time. But it's actually funny that last week we went to the training ground to watch them train and get some photos and autographs, of course, because that's all part of the game here.
Yeah, yeah.
I was pretty sure that Okubo was going to start up front, judging from what I saw in the few sort of training matches. There was clearly a first 11 playing a second 11. But, and I guess he was the one player out of our three, one got injured, Oshima got injured, so he was obviously not going to play. Kudamaya didn't play in Belgium at all, so he was basically just there for a nice little trip, I think.
Yeah.
So it kind of made sense that Kobayashi was starting on the bench, but I don't know. I have a few issues with Oniki at the moment, it's fair to say.
All right, yeah, well, feel free to share. We're an open and honest forum here for thoughts and feelings. So, yeah, spill your guts if you like, Neil. What's Mr. Oniki done to get your goat up?
Well, it's I feel kind of petty complaining about this, but I think he's a lucky manager so far, which is great. I'm delighted to have a lucky manager. But recently, I think, like, at the end of last season, at the start of this season, he seems to be quite a petty person. And if someone makes one mistake, they really get hung out to dry. That is if they're not one of the sort of the big name players. So it happened to Edu in the Levan Cup last year. I mean, that was a horrendous clanger. But he disappeared from the squad for the rest of the year, and it seemed a bit petty. And then the same thing's happened to my beloved Nara this year. He apparently made a couple of mistakes, which, I mean, everybody's made a couple of mistakes this year.
Yep.
And he disappeared from the squad. He's made it back onto the bench now, but it's weird that Oniki thinks that it's better to play one of our internationals. Our international left back is now being played in centre back. Because he's better at centre back than the rest of the centre backs in our squad, apart from Taniguchi. And it just seems, I don't know, I feel like he's, I don't want to say he's a petty person, but he seems to be quite petty, Oniki, that he finds something that he's not happy about, and then he'll sort of hang you out to dry for a few weeks or a few months even. So looking at that training ground, I was thinking, Nara's back or Edu's back, because both of them were playing in the first 11 versus the second 11. Mm-hmm. And then Kurumaya's off the plane, straight on the pitch, and Edu's disappeared. Nara's on the bench, and yeah, it's weird. But who am I to criticise? I mean, he won us the league last year, and he knows a lot more about football than I do. So, yeah, I can't complain too much, but it feels a bit weird. Feels a bit weird.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Okay, well, I'm glad you had the opportunity to vent a little bit there, and fair enough. Now it's probably time to get your goat up even higher, Neil, but because, obviously, Frontale, you mentioned the first 85 minutes weren't great. There were a few chances here and there for your side to take the lead. Okubo himself forced a decent enough save from Takuto Hayashi early doors, and just before half-time, Hiroyuki Abe headed straight at Hayashi from a promising central position. But then, it all kicked off in the last 5 minutes, and, you mentioned before we started recording, Neil, you weren't aware, but while you're at the ground, but yeah, apparently Patrick was offside for the award of the corner that was that ultimately led to Hiroshima's goal. But notwithstanding, the goal itself was just an absolute horror show for Jung Sung Ryong, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's it's a weakness of his, but I think that he loves to punch. And there's no reason for him to punch that. He could have caught it. It wasn't the first ball. It wasn't difficult to catch. It wasn't going to bobble out. He could have just caught it, but he kind of, well, I wouldn't call it a punch. It was more like as the face or something.
Yeah.
Ball. And yeah, it was nasty. But I think I was talking to one of my Frontale friends, and we said that's why we've got him rather than playing like in the Premier League or something, because I think he's a fantastic keeper, but now and again he just makes some real clangers. He was definitely one of the players of the season last year, so I'm totally happy to forgive him for the occasional flap or flop or whatever you called it. But yeah, it wasn't a nice goal to see back. We were at the other end of the stadium, so didn't really appreciate it at the time, but yeah, it wasn't fun to watch that replay, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, well, Jung basically is caught off balance, isn't he, when the corner swung in. Patrick's initial header basically loops up in the air, but yeah, with Jung slightly off balance, he has to come back towards the ball, and as you say, a punch is being generous, I suppose. I think he does actually lay two hands on the ball, but he basically, it deflects off his hands, shall we say. I think Sho Sasaki probably deserves a little bit of credit. I think he actually does nod it down for Patrick to sweep it in. And the first replay I saw, it looked like it just came off Sasaki's head, but I think you could probably, if you wanted to give him credit, you could see a slight motion for him to nod down and then obviously Patrick's celebrations were on for Hiroshima. They look like they were going to be fairly short-lived as the clock ticked over at the end of the 90th minute, Neil, and then one of the strangest decisions that has come down so far in this already action-packed, action's not the right word, but a season packed already with the refereeing controversies. Well, this was just about taking the cake. A dreadfully, wrongfully ruled-out goal that should have been a perfectly legal for Tatsuya Hasegawa. As I say, as the 90 minutes expired, and I don't know, you want to talk us through it? You probably want to forget it as quickly as possible, Neil, but I think for the listeners, we probably better let them fully understand what happened, and you were obviously behind that goal, so what you saw of it and what you made of the controversy as it unfolded.
Well, we're actually even in a better place than behind the goal. We're right sort of by the corner, really, so.
Oh, right.
We have a perfect angle. I mean, everyone around me saw nothing wrong with it. and to be honest, the thing about this particular decision was the fact that the linesman hadn't flagged. The ref appeared to have given it. And then it was just when the players started having a go at the linesman that he started reconsidering. And I mean, I know people make mistakes. It's easy to make mistakes. And you know, these things go for you and against you over the course of the season. But that was the really weird thing. We had the ball back on the centre spot, celebrating, and then there was some few guys, you know, around the linesman, and everything seemed to sort of be reconsidered. It was quite a weird one. And well, I mean, yeah, I don't want to think about it too much, and I don't want to whinge too much, because I know people said that our goal against Nagoya was offside, which I look back and I've convinced myself that it wasn't. So I guess there's this kind of thing of being a fan of one team, is that two fans of oppositions can look at the same footage and come to opposite conclusions. But it was pretty clear this decision was totally wrong. I mean, you know, get played onside by one player and get called offside is unfortunate, but it was three of them, so it was quite a bad decision. But I'm more concerned about the way that the ref and the linesman seem to be convinced by protests rather than convinced to change their minds. Oh, that's how it looked like it to me. And like I said to you earlier, I haven't really watched back the highlights very closely yet, because I don't really want to.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, you said you had a perfect view of it, so I presume you could see Hiroshima defender Taki Iwada lying on the floor on the end line playing everybody on site, because that's what exactly he was doing, and how the linesman couldn't see that. It was over the other side of the pitch, but still, I mean, you know, he's there, he's lying on the floor. I mean, the ball comes off the Hiroshima defender twice, Mizumoto, so there's no danger of you know, Kawasaki player playing the ball to a teammate in an offside position, even though he clearly wasn't, Hasegawa. And, yeah, as you say, basically, yeah, Mizumoto hasn't rushed over to the linesman. I think the captain, Aoyama, and a couple of other of his teammates have done so. And, yes, what they've said, I have absolutely no idea. I don't know if they have any incriminating photos of the linesman's family or anything like that, or what, goodness knows. But for some absolutely, unconscionable reason. Both the linesman and the referee have decided to overturn the initial decision to award the goal, because that's what it looked like was going to be the case. And then it's you've ended up on the short end of this particular stick. I don't know. I didn't actually see any people planning about the goal in the Nagoya game. Was that a few mentions you saw on Twitter, or was that floating around in the Twitter sphere? Or because that seemed like a reasonable enough goal to me, the Yokoba one.
Yeah, I think maybe these things come to my attention more than anyone else's. That just I'm kind of criticism of Frontale seems to fly towards me and upset me. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, maybe it was just a few people, but one was enough to hurt my feelings. So.
Fair enough then. All right, so yes, the top of the table clash, it went the way of Hiroshima, and along with Sendai, they are now the two teams that yet to taste defeat so far in the new season. Frontale slipping from first to third in the table. 3 points behind San Frecce. Coming up for Frontale next weekend on Sunday is the Kanagawa Derby away at Yokohama F. Marinos at the Nissan Stadium. So that's a huge one for you, Neil. But before that, Kawasaki, of course, are in China on Wednesday night playing against Shanghai SIPG, who lead your ACL Group F, and they're way out of sight for Frontale, who you need two wins and a lot of help to have any chance of making it through to the knockout stages. Neil, it doesn't look likely, does it? And very frustrating, I'm sure, for you ACL campaign so far.
Yeah, frustrating, but obviously we want to win every game, but the ACL was probably the one I was least interested in for some reason. I don't know why. But it would have been nice to get out the group. But I think the two performances against Melbourne were the killers. The first two games we played pretty badly. Thankfully, I didn't see either of them, but it seems that we were pretty terrible. And, the less said about the Melbourne games, the better. I think that it's just we were awful again. And it's, I don't know, it's funny that we just haven't started well at all this year. It was my opinion. And then I thought, I'll just check how we started last year, and the records are almost identical. Mm. So it's weird that the same thing happens every year. But yeah, ACL tomorrow, not tomorrow. I don't know when this is coming out, but Wednesday's game against Shanghai is it crucial or is it pointless? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't even know how he's going to choose a team. I guess he has to choose a strong team to sort of show that we're still willing. But to be honest, we're cooked, I think. So it would be nice to just to get those last ACL games out of the way and try and forget about it. It hasn't been a good year in that competition.
Yes, indeed. Disappointing, frustrating, whichever word you want to use here for Frontale. It looks like the round of 16 will be a bridge too far, but we shall see. You never know. Obviously, the side is capable of anything on its day, and we'll see what sort of a side Mr. Oniki takes, to China. If they can stun the group leaders there, the final match day on the 18th of April will be home against Ulsan of South Korea. And depending on what happens with Ulsan playing against Melbourne Victory on Wednesday night, then they might already be through to the round of 16 themselves. So we'll wait and see on that. That's the ACL wrap. Of course, we've done the other three groups with Alan in part one. All right then, well, we'll look ahead to Sunday then, Neil. It hasn't been a great start to the season. At least that's the way it seems that you're feeling. Of course, we had you on the first time the podcast after the match day one win away at Iwata, when yes, your 3-0 win saw you top the table after match day one, and well, yeah, third place after five games. A lot of teams would kill to be in that position, but it sounds like you're not overwhelmed with the way things have gone so far. But there's nothing like a derby to get your side back on track and focused for the coming months, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely, that's true. And I would say that I'm happy with the third place. I'm just not happy with the way we're playing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to appear to be like a spoilt brat saying third is no good for us, but third is great. But just, yeah, the manner of the performances has been terrible. So it's like every game I feel is papering over the cracks of what's happened before it. So we haven't played well. And even, to be honest, the terrible decision in the last game has kind of given us an excuse and given us a reason not to look at why we're playing so badly at the moment. So It's a bit scary. But like you said, yeah, Yokohama, it's a pretty exciting game, although it was a pretty terrible game last year. And I think around about this time last year, we played your guys away from home in an exciting early season derby to kickstart the season, and we got thumped 3-0 by you. So
I do remember that, yeah.
Cautiously, I would say cautiously optimistic. I think cautiously hopeful is the way to approach this. I don't know. I'm really confused about what's happening with us. But like I said, almost exactly the same as last season. So you called me, I was looking at some of my thoughts on the blog post from last year. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the same things are coming up over and over again, like loads of chances, can't take them. Why is Sonri punching all the time?
Right.
What's going on with the substitutions? It's weird. So it just shows you how little difference a year and a title can make. I can still come back the next start of next season and be really whingy. So I'm sorry about that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You're really right. Your record is exactly the same after five games. Yeah, 3 wins, one draw, and one loss. The only difference is you're third now, and you were sixth after five games last season. A lot more bunched up at the top with Kobe and Kashima making fast starts. But yes, well, yeah, the form book goes out the window, etc., etc. In a derby. Yes, we hope there's fireworks with Yokohama hosting. What do you think Mr. Oniki will do, Neil? Do you think Okubo showed enough in his first league start to earn another one? I'm sure Kobayashi will return to the 11, but do you think Okubo might be a chance to partner him up front, or what do you think he'll do?
I think he's going to just do what he normally does and go back to the usual 11. I don't think Okubo was particularly convincing. I mean, he has good moments. But I was a little bit worried that towards the end of the last game, he was reverting to how he was in the last third of the season when he was with us 2 years ago, that he looked like he was getting frustrated and he was dropping deeper and deeper. So I think he'll be a really useful sub for us this year, but I don't think he will be starting many games, and I don't think he did enough to start the next game. So I think, yeah, and Kobayashi will be back up front, I'm sure, which is another kind of peeve of mine, maybe, that Oniki will never play Abe up front. He always plays him on the left. Although last season, when we played Abe up front and Kobayashi on the right, Abe scored loads of goals. So it's another one of those kind of mental blocks that I feel like he's got, where Kobayashi's fit, therefore he starts there. Mm-hmm. We concede a goal, therefore the defender who isn't Taniguchi gets blamed for it. So he seems to have these kind of patterns that he falls into. This is, you know, amateur opinion, but I think we'll be back to how we were in the last game before the international break, apart from Oshima, of course, who's injured again. Poor glass Oshima. he seems to get crocked pretty much by anything at any time. So
yeah,
it's a shame, and no idea how long he's out for. But yeah, I imagine he won't be back. But I did see a certain Mr. Manabu Saito playing full practice games at the training ground. So
that would be
quite something, wouldn't it? Quite a bold move if he was to play some part.
Goodness me.
I wonder if it would be a little bit too much too early, but it might be worth putting him on the bench just for the mental barrage it might give. That's a bit of mental ammunition, so I don't know.
It would certainly make the atmosphere inside the Nissan Stadium very, very highly charged indeed, you would have to imagine. If Marino's supporters were to get a sight of their former captain, of course, last season's captain, Manabu Saito, in a Kawasaki kit for the first time. So that would definitely throw the cat amongst the pigeons. But, as you say, probably too soon. Do you know how long he's been back in full training, Neil?
Well, I'm not
shady
sure
with the details.
It's a few weeks, I think. And he was fully taking part. There were a few players who were sort of on the edges who I guess have got knocks or something. But he was totally involved, so I imagine maybe it won't be too long before he's playing. But we'll see. I mean, I don't want to second guess anyone, but I think it might happen sooner rather than later. And yeah, maybe it would be quite something if it did happen this weekend, but probably not.
Yes. So the Kanagawa Derby is probably the biggest game on the slate. It's always a big occasion, of course. The match day 6, it gets started with 5 games on Saturday. Sapporo host Nagoya. Iwata entertain Shimizu. It is quite a big derby weekend, so we can't forget the Shizuoka one there, of course. The Iwata hosting Shimizu at the Stadium Ekopa. Seresaka host Tosu Urawa. Begin the Tsuyoshi Otsuki rain, however short that will be, when they host Sendai. So as I said earlier with Alan, that's second from bottom hosting a second from top, and most of us would have thought that would be in reverse. At the Shonan host Kashima in the late game on Saturday, then 4 games on Sunday. Nagasaki host FC Tokyo. Kashiwa Reysol entertain leaders Hiroshima. It's a Kansai derby with Gamba Osaka hosting Kobe, so Alan's allegiances are definitely split there. And then, the late afternoon game on Sunday is the one we've just been talking about, the Kanagawa Derby, Yokohama hosting Kawasaki. So quite a big weekend, Neil, in J1 with the 3 big derbies, Shizuoka, Kansai and Kanagawa. So, should be a really entertaining match day, you'd imagine.
Yeah, definitely. There's plenty to look out for. Lots of interesting potential stories this weekend. And that Urawa thing has come as quite a shock to me. And a little bit of a disappointment. I was hoping they'd keep him on for a bit longer.
Indeed. Yeah, well, there's plenty of us who don't mind seeing Urawa struggle down at the wrong end of the table. And, when they're alongside Gamba, that makes it even better. For some of it, that's early doors, of course, far too early to jump to conclusions, even though the Reds board have indeed just done that. We'll leave it there for this week. Neil's been to catch up with you again. Just before you go, please fill the listeners in, those who are already not following you on Twitter, how they can do so, and indeed your blog on Kawasaki Frontale.
Oh, that's you know what? I can't remember the actual Twitter name, but it's Frontale Rabbit Blog on Blogger or Blogspot. So from there, you'll be able to get it. I think if you just type Frontale Rabbit, it will come up. So yeah, the magic of Google.
It's at Frontale Rabbit. Yes.
Oh, thank you very much.
And the blog and regularly updated. Not how long your post was on Saturday. Can't imagine it would have been too long. As you say, not wanting to revisit that game in too much detail.
Actually, it's pretty long. I haven't put it up yet. I wrote it yesterday and I wanted to sort of sit on it for a sleep on it. So I'll put it up tomorrow morning. But I'm mainly it's self-flagellation rather than referee criticism.
Fair enough.
So, I always moan about referees, so there's no more referee moaning than usual on this one. So, yeah, I keeping that part concise, perhaps.
All right then. It's been great to catch up with you, as I said, Neil. And hope to speak to you again soon.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot for having me again.
No worries at all. All right, my thanks again to Alan Gibson and to Neil Debnam, and of course to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to wrap up what is sure to be an action-packed J1 Match 6. Speak to you again then. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.